This is Phantom Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air with Kristen Jones, life coach specializing in helping emotional eaters. And I want to thank you for being on the podcast tonight. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing great. So happy to be here, and I appreciate you having me.
Want to let people know we are a featured podcast on Newsly. You might see that icon up there. If you use the coupon code GHOST, you can check it out for free for 30 days. It will be on Newsly as an audio-only version of this episode later tonight. And we do have your breakthrough emotional eating, and that's your Instagram, right?
Yep.
So that will be, people will be able to check that out on Instagram and use that username to get there. And again, thank you for being on the show. One of the first things we always ask anybody who's on the show as a guest is, what motivates you and why do you do what you do?
I help emotional eaters. So I'm a life coach, and I help specifically emotional eaters change their relationship with food, but more importantly, change their relationships with themselves. And the reason I do that is because I am, and I will say, like an alcoholic who's always an alcoholic, even when they're in recovery, I am an emotional eater, and I've always been an emotional eater all of my life. And I would consider myself in recovery now, but, I have discovered what works for me in managing my relationship with food and managing my relationship with myself. And since I've discovered that, I have wanted to share that with other people, just because I know how difficult it is to have a challenging relationship with food. And so that is, I feel like, for a while, I felt like this emotional eating was, you know, kind of a curse to me, and it was something that that I just was a victim of it. And instead, now I feel like it was given to me so I could learn to deal with it and then share with others how I overcame it and help them do the same.
Yeah, adversities tend to be a driver. A lot of times, I've talked to people that have had crucible moments or trauma on this podcast over the years. And it really, you know, these moments that some people try to, you know, bury moments, but a lot of times it's a teaching moment, it's a learning moment. And then when you realize that you can actually teach other people and people can learn from you, then it's like, you know, you can help the whole world with the benefit of what your experience is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I definitely feel like this was a bigger picture. I was just one person, but this issue was given to me, and I know that it was given to me so I then could take what I learned and share it with other people and hopefully change other people's lives as well.
So if you go maybe back to the beginning of like telling your whole story, I don't know if you want to give like the elevator pitch version, or like, you know, depends on how far deep you want to go. It's up to you. But
absolutely.
How do you find yourself specializing in this? I know you mentioned that you had the issue yourself. So maybe you can tell that story and then talk about like maybe your epiphanies about how you solved it or working on it.
Absolutely. So I have been an emotional eater. I can remember being seven or 8 years old and just being very fixated and focused on food and not really understanding why. And that kind of, you know, moved through my early childhood. I probably went on my first diet when I was in seventh grade, and was always obsessed with my weight and with body image. And I come from a family that's from the South, and so food was always a focus of our lives. Everything revolved around food, which, again, I love food. There's nothing wrong with that, but it was definitely something that was a focus in my life. And I didn't really recognize that I actually had an eating disorder until I was probably in my mid-30s. And I kind of managed it. I just kind of thought that there was just nothing really, that everybody kind of did this, that this was just kind of the way things were. People had this really strong love-hate relationship with food. And it wasn't until, and I was a school teacher. In my previous life, I was a school teacher and I taught middle school. And I left in 2017 to start my own fitness and nutrition business online. And what I realized was that I couldn't, I, I, I really couldn't diet, or I couldn't do what I was asking my clients to do wasn't working for them. And it didn't work for me either, in a sense of being able to kind of control my weight. And I realized there was some sort of, I knew I had an issue. I knew that it was time to deal with it. And so here I was trying to coach other people, and I didn't have the answers to my own issues. And so I started to see a life coach in regards to some money issues. And I've come to realize that there are very strong parallels between food issues and money issues, that people have the same types of thoughts about scarcity, and that you're not going to have enough. And so you have a tendency to, you know, either overeat, or you have a scarcity mentality when it comes to money, and those two things kind of run hand in hand. And so I worked with this life coach, and she was doing all of these things, looking back into my childhood and how I was raised and the ideas I was given about money. And as we were working on this, I started to realize that it was so similar to what my issues were with food. And so we never worked on the food part of it, but I realized that what she had done with me had really helped me in the way of working through my issues with money. That I took what she taught me, and I kind of started to experiment on myself. And then I started listening to other people and doing other things. But the epiphany for me, and how I help my clients not only manage their emotional eating, but also how to lose weight, because most emotional eaters usually have they usually have a desire to lose some weight. And so one of the epiphanies for me was, one day I was watching my father, and my father had not changed his weight from the entire time I was alive, more than 5 pounds, and always ate what he wanted. And I kept thinking, how does he do that? And it's because he eats when he's hungry, and he stops when he's full, or stops when he's satisfied. And to an emotional eater, that's just like, you can't even imagine that, because once you start eating, you just keep eating, because you're not eating because you're hungry, you're eating for other reasons. And so when I watched him, I was like, oh, okay, there's something to that. But I wasn't at the place where I was ready to deal with the mental part of it, which my dad really never had any issues with that. But my issue was very strongly mentally related. And so I started just kind of experimenting with that idea of not restricting myself. It's very, very scary for when you're an emotional eater. And eventually I ended up, because I was having such issues with my own clients, I decided to kind of explore and look into the life coaching aspect of how do we change our thoughts? How do our thoughts, you know, create our beliefs and our feelings? And then how does that change our actions? So I ended up going to life coaching school right at the beginning of COVID. I started in March of 2020, and I finished in September, and had a completely different outlook on how we go about doing things in our lives. And that was kind of the start of the change for me, was taking a look not only at my own, really looking at my own issues, but realizing that weight loss and emotional eating has nothing to do with food. And it has everything to do with your thoughts, your feelings, and your beliefs about yourself. And so I had to start doing all the work myself, and then in turn started really helping my clients, and then really saw some pretty dramatic changes with my clients. And I wrote a book. I have a book on Amazon. It's called When Food Is Your Drug. And it is pretty much, you know, it kind of lays out how food can be used as in the same way.
Be addictive. Like, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you can fall into any addiction, like, you know, gambling or any of the normal, you know, I think that a lot of times it's the relationship you have with food.
Right.
Because if you use food as like what the, I guess the kind of happy medium is, like, like your father, like he ate when he was, you know, till he was full, you know, ate at certain times. He didn't have it as like a crutch, like some people have it, you know, gambling or other addictive things, and food can fall into the same zone. Like if you have addictive personality, maybe the trait, and then your choice was food was the comfort.
Right. So, and the opening line of my book is, I wish I had been a drug addict. And I really meant that, because if somebody has a drinking issue or they have a drug issue, when you decide that that's a problem and you're going to get rid of it, you get rid of it. And it's no longer a part of your life. Food is not something, food's something you have to live with. You have food to develop.
It's harder. Yeah. If you get addicted to food, it's like you need three meals a day to be on the planet.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
And then like, if you're having a trouble trying to moderate that, well, it's not something you can, you can't stay away from it.
Right.
Because you have to learn how to manage it, which must be a lot harder.
Right.
Because alcoholics are not told how to manage the beer. Like you shouldn't have it.
Yeah, you just get rid of it. Exactly. It's an all or nothing. And food can't be an all or nothing. And yeah. I remember hearing a long time ago that food issues are far and away from an addiction standpoint, they are the hardest addiction to overcome because any type of eating disorder, because of the fact that we always have to have food in our lives and we cannot get rid of it. And so that it makes it really challenging. And that's one of the reasons why I don't believe that you ever end emotional eating, but that you learn to manage it. You just learn to manage it. And that's what I do.
Yeah, a lot of times with addictions, like, you know, it's all or nothing, but a lot of times you do have to have a management for the rest of your life. Like you have to learn how to manage the emotional state that brings you to there, right?
Right.
So it goes into the mental, but then it's like a lot of times there's pillars, right?
Yeah.
Things are mental, but then they're physical and then they're spiritual and there's like the heart's involved. So then there's like, all those things are foo-foo. So everybody's looking for something they can find on a chart.
Right.
But sometimes it's like your spirit, right? And your heart and your soul, like that's hard to, like, you know what the food's doing, right? You can see it's increasing the weight or you're decreasing the weight or you're doing, but what is your mental state doing? How do you get to that, the mind frame, the mindset?
Right.
They're like, you're talking about the scarcity mindset. Mm-hmm. Like maybe you can talk about like, do you have the abundance? Do you have scarcity? And then you're like, you're being triggered to think that you don't have enough or you need to have more. And so maybe you can talk about like what causes that emotional situation.
Absolutely. So one of the things, probably the, I think for me, the phrase that I learned that I think changed everything for me was food's not going anywhere. And that's what I learned to tell myself because it used to be, and I kid you not but this is the truth. I was a school teacher. I would eat very little during the school day. And the moment I got home from school, I would eat from the time I got home to school from school to the time I went to bed. And it was, you know, it was just snacking. It was just grazing. I mean, I ate the entire time. And it was that mindset of, and it was again, that scarcity mindset of, oh my gosh, I've got to eat it now because tomorrow I'm going to be good again. I'm going to start over. I'm going to be good on my diet and I'm going to follow through. And so I have to eat all of it now. And there was a period of my life where I couldn't keep food in my house at all. I would have to go to the store, buy what I was going to have for dinner, and then I would eat it all, and then it was done. And that was the only way I was able to kind of get through. Right. And that was, a very difficult time. But the scarcity and what it triggers that panic in our brain. Our brain doesn't like to be denied things. Our brain, because we create desire in our own brain. So if somebody has a desire for something, whether it's a drink, whether it's, you know, fast food, whether it's clothes, whether it's a lifestyle, it's because they've created that story in their head and they've made it this thing that is so valuable to them. And when they don't have it, that just escalates the brain to want it even more. And it's kind of like, I always equate it to, it's like when your parents told you not to hang out with a certain kid because, oh, they were bad news. And oh my God, you were going to go to the ends of the earth to be able to hang out with that kid, even if you didn't like them, but you were going to do it just because your parents told you couldn't.
You're not to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's just, that is just human nature. That's the way our brain works. And so when you realize that, that's why I come in when it comes to managing weight and again, addressing emotional eating. I come from the standpoint of, I don't believe in diets. I do not think they work. And so, because it just sets up that repeating pattern. And so in my world with my clients, it is everything, nothing is off limits, but because it, then your brain relaxes because it knows, okay, I know I can, I'm never, it's not like I'm never going to have this again. I'm just going to get to decide.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere. Yeah.
Right. It's not going anywhere. Like,
it's a stress hormone. Like a lot of times we feel like the wolf's at the door.
Right.
We want to feel safe. Is there's a lot of emotional eating, trying to feel like a security blanket, the safe that makes you feel safe in the comfort of the food is like somebody who feels like, well, I got to lock that door because the world is coming.
Right.
Is it the same kind of thing?
Absolutely. And these things are all created from, there was a time, I would say probably almost maybe 20 or 30 years ago, where no one wanted to talk about their childhood and everybody blames parents and it's all everybody's parents' fault. But the bottom line is every one of the beliefs that we have about ourselves and what we think about ourselves was established within the first 6 years of our lives.
Yeah,
and we've heard valuable
your child. Like that ends up being the main driver of all the issues a lot of adults have.
Absolutely.
Like those things that have foundational things like the limiting beliefs.
Right.
People not thinking that they're good enough or the toxic situations.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets like framed in your it's programmed in your brain. It's like, it's there. You kind of got to reprogram your brain to say like, yeah, I can get beyond that.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. And so it knowing that, and again, and one of the things that I will always stress with clients, I stress it in my book, is that it's not about blame. It's not about pointing the finger at anybody and saying, you know, you did this to me. Oh my gosh, how? Because then we stay in victim mode, and nobody moves forward when they're a victim. And so it's always just accepting that there is no perfect parent out there. Sorry for those people who think that they're a perfect parent. There's no perfect parent out there, and that everybody does the best they can given the information and the tools that they have. And I honestly always want to believe that nobody wakes up in the morning and says, gosh, I really want to screw my kid up. Let me tell them these things. Let me say these things to them. I don't believe that there are people who do that. And so these things happen. And so then as an adult, we get to make the decision. Do I want to continue thinking like a six-year-old, or do I want to decide I'm an adult and I get to start changing my thought patterns? I get to change my beliefs. And people can reinvent themselves at any point in time in their lives. Is it easy? Absolutely not. It's pretty simple.
It's a lot of hard work.
It's a lot of hard work. But most people don't, and I'll be honest, most people don't, they're not that fired up about doing that kind of work because it can be really painful. Really painful.
Well, a lot of times, like, you know, you could be in a codependent relationship, but it's more comfortable to be in that discomfort than to try something new because you're more scared of something new.
Absolutely.
You see that a lot in the codependency because people will stay in something that you look at it from the outside and say, how could you stay in that?
Right.
But in your mind state, like, it's more comfortable to stay in that
because it's familiar.
Harder to try something new because that's scary.
Mm-hmm.
That's the wolf at the door. It's like, I don't know if I can do that.
Right.
I don't know if I'll be safe.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow I'm safe here, but maybe not as safe as I could be, but I could be more less safe if I try the other thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think codependency and people pleasing are oftentimes, those are very strong. I won't say every emotional eater is a people pleaser or codependent, but there are pretty strong some parallels between those. And that in my experience, and I know that's true for me. And in my experience with clients that I've worked with, there's always a little bit of that running through them as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of times people, I don't know if this is an issue, but I find it with a lot of people I deal with, creatives, and there's this tendency to want to do things to make it perfect.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm kind of a person that I've kind of accepted, like, imperfection is part of art. Mm-hmm. Imperfection is part, like, so if I do something and it's not exactly perfect, it's actually kind of like a painting. Like, it is that moment in time when you do that layer, and you could always do it different, but that painting represents that moment.
Right.
So when you start to, but a lot of tools we have today, I can go and make a piece of music totally like the beat is totally in time. There are no harmonic errors. There are no timing errors. I could actually go on the computer and correct it.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, it sounds very antiseptic. It doesn't sound real. It sounds kind of fake.
Yeah.
And then you're like, so then you present yourself like people on social media. They can Photoshop their face. That's not really who they are. They can AI their dialogue. That's not really what they wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of like presenting yourself to be this perfect thing, and then you're not even authentic.
Right. Right. And so
they kind of go back to like, can you be vulnerable?
Right. Right. Well, and perfectionism is also a very strong, again, that's another strong character trait of emotional eaters, because again, there's that idea of, I'll eat it all now because I'm going to be perfect tomorrow. And so, you know, and everything is that, well, when I get I'll be perfect then, but right now I need to eat as much as I can just to kind of get myself.
Some level of procrastination with a kind of like a perfection mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So like you can say, well, I have tomorrow to do it, get it perfect.
Right.
Now I have to do this because it's scarcity now.
Mm-hmm. So yeah.
It's still in the same, like, oh, you got to kind of unlearn those things.
Right.
Or learn how to manage those right. impulses.
Right.
And realize, like, you know, anybody's addictive, like the impulse to gamble.
Yeah.
Even though you know, like, you could lose your house. Like,
well, and a lot of that comes from the thoughts. It always, everything originates in our thoughts. And so one of the things that I address, so much of how I work with clients, I mean, and again, when I say it's not about food, it really isn't about food. I mean, I very rarely ever talk to my clients about food. In fact, I don't give any nutrition advice or guidance.
I'm not a dietitian.
Right. It's not in my wheelhouse. But what I do look at, and what I have always found is that food issues are what we call, it's the buffer. It's the thing that people do. And it could be drugs. It could be alcohol. In my case, food was the most convenient, and it was the one I wasn't going to get in trouble for. Cause I had very strict parents, and it was like,
you don't want to do the legal, the bad,
right.
The bad, you know, you don't want to be like the bad people.
Right.
So you had limited like wiggle room to find like something to be have comfort. So you had like a kind of gate. It's like, I'm never going to go past this.
Oh, yeah.
Within here, then I could go because there's nothing wrong with that. But
right.
Then there actually is something wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it actually hurts you.
Right. Because it's socially acceptable. It's not a problem. And making food for people or consuming other people's food, well, that's a really nice thing. There's no problem with that. And, so when we call that, it's buffering is when you are using something else to either distract, to avoid, or to just pretend like it doesn't exist, this other issue. And so what I really do with my clients is we really work on initially is trying to figure out what is the other thing in their life? What's the elephant in the room that they're not addressing? And instead they're eating all the time because they don't want to deal with this other uncomfortable issue.
An elephant in the room they don't address is really the source of why they are where they are.
Once you figure out what that is and you realize what it is and then you address that, then the weight loss, I mean, you don't even have to try because you then take that desire and that need to distract from it because now you're ready to deal with it. Now you can lean into it. The other thing that is really something that I think this is just in our society in general, is most people, actually I'd say all people naturally don't want to feel discomfort. We want to stay away from any, we want to go towards pleasure. We want to stay away from pain. And one of the things that probably one of the most valuable things, those valuable concepts I learned in life coaching school was that life is 50-50. And it doesn't matter if you're the guy on the street or if you're Richard Branson, it does not matter. You are going to have 50% of the time that life is amazing and 50% of the time it is absolutely horrible. And nobody gets away with 70-30, 60-40. Everyone gets 50-50. And the more you can adapt and be okay and lean in to the discomfort and the uncomfortable times and the uncomfortable feelings, the easier your life becomes, because you realize when we try to avoid it, it's like that. It's like the monster outside the door. We make it this huge.
Can we have this fairy tale or this image of what life should be?
Right.
And then if there's anything that doesn't match that, then it kind of forces us to go into these crutches for their addiction. Because like, oh, I have this idealized vision for love. Mm-hmm. Like I have an idealized vision for my career. And then when it doesn't hit the mark, which a lot of times it won't, right?
No, so, at least not at first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As an artist, a lot of times we look at it, right? Mm-hmm. I can do 100 demos. Probably only two of them are going to be successful.
Right.
Right. So am I going to give up? Or I realize that that's the price of being an artist. It's like a lot of what I create is not going to go past the cutting room floor. This is the way it is. But do I look at that as a negative thing? Or do I look at that as a positive thing? I can look at back at all those tracks and say, I learned something.
Right.
Or I can say, well, they're a waste of time. Like if you think all 98 tracks are a waste of time, that's probably not the right mind frame to be in. If you look at each one of those was an opportunity,
right,
then you have a different mind frame.
Right. And failure, and again, the idea and the concept of failure, and this was another thing that was really driven home when I was studying to be a life coach, is that we get to choose how we want to see any situation, any circumstance that we are presented with. And so if we want to see failure as being a bad thing, you absolutely can. But you can also see failure as just another opportunity to grow, another opportunity to learn, and then to try again. And that there's an in my coaching, there is never anything wrong with failure. In fact, you want failure. What you don't want to do is you don't want to quit. We can fail all we want, but you cannot quit on yourself. You have to be there because then you've given up on yourself. And we don't want anybody to give up on themselves.
I think that's a lot of the problems today is that you get a lot of people that are scared to be vulnerable, right? Mm-hmm. They're scared to present because they think the hater's gonna not like it, right? So they post on Instagram and they get 5 likes and they get scared. Like, oh, I'm not gonna post anymore because I'm not getting enough, right? Instead of this idea, like, well, if I keep on showing up, it could be an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of musicians, they'll say, like Herbie Hancock said one time, it's a really important thing, there are no bad notes, because Miles Davis kind of told him. Because one day he was playing with Miles, and he hit the wrong chord in the arrangement, and he thought it was going to be the end, right? Because he was new in the group, and he was like, "Oh, Miles is going to throw me out." Miles actually took that chord and changed the direction of the song, and then later said, "That's not bad, Herbie. He's like, you gave me an opportunity to evolve the song."
Right.
So then you start to realize, like, there's no real bad note. There's an opportunity. If you perceive it to be a bad note, the whole band can stop. Mm-hmm. And say, oh, you hit the wrong note. Or they can actually take it and evolve the song.
Right.
If you have that mindset that I can take that note as an opportunity to evolve the song, then it's not what everybody could perceive it to be the wrong note for that composition. It doesn't have to be.
Right. Well, and again, it all comes down to, we don't have every circumstance in our life, like that note, every circumstance is neutral. It doesn't mean anything until we attach meaning to it. So, you know, to anybody else, I mean, obviously to Miles, it was like, well, that's an opportunity. Like it wasn't any big deal. You know, to Herbie, it was, oh my gosh, I blew it. You know, everybody gets an opportunity to decide how they want to view something and then where they want that to go. And so this is another thing that I really try to instill in my clients, because understanding that life is going to throw you so many curveballs and so many things out of left field, and that that's okay, that's what it's supposed to do. It's not supposed to be perfect all the time. And that's one of the things that is so challenging about social media, is that we have to keep reminding ourselves, and we have to remember that people put their best stuff up on social media, and everybody puts up the perfect image, and that's not reality. That's not their life. When your life's going crazy, when your life's terrible, you think, oh my gosh, everybody else has it so much better than me. And we just have to keep reminding ourselves that we all get it 50-50. Nobody gets it any better than that. And so reminding yourself of that and knowing that, you know, everybody does the same kinds of stuff, goes through the same things. And as long as we can remember that, then we don't have to take, if we can stay more at an even keel as opposed to so many extreme ups and downs, that's really what gets people into trouble as well.
Also, sometimes like the quantity versus the quality, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people on social media, like I said, you get two views, and this other guy got a million views. Mm-hmm. But what if the one view you got was from somebody that gives you an opportunity? So the guy who had a million views, it's not actually equatable.
Yeah.
So this is why I try to tell people, is like, mm-hmm. showing up gives you an opportunity. Mm-hmm. If you show up, somebody might come to you and give you a pitch. And then so versus the guy that's got, you know, the cat video with the same song on it, gets mm-hmm. a million views. Well, everybody's heard that and everybody's seen a video kind of like that. It's like, so he's just hitting the algorithm. That doesn't mean it's good.
Right.
They just means mm-hmm. it's hitting the algorithm. Mm-hmm. So the people got to understand is like the individuality of you being a human being and you mm-hmm. having lessons learned, that makes you who you are. And it's nothing bad about that. That actually builds up your character and builds up your personality.
Oh, people absolutely.
Start realizing that's life instead of mm-hmm. being a detriment.
Right.
Then they'll have a different view of life.
Yeah. And the cool part is one of the things that people really don't oftentimes want to hear is that where their life is in their current situation, whether they like it or whether they don't like it. And most people, when they come to a life coach, they want to kind of up level their life. So there's something that they're not happy with. When, you know, I have to break the news to them that, you know, you are where you are because of you, like because of your thoughts, because of your feelings, because of your actions, like you're the cause. And some people get so upset and so offended by that, but I will tell them like the exciting part is it can change right now. And it only has to start changing by you changing how you think, like in this exact moment, like you're not waiting for anybody else to change. You're not waiting to read a book. You're not waiting to take a course. You can just start thinking differently in this exact moment. And so that becomes empowering.
I think a lot of times because people are looking for the outside thing that caused mm-hmm. it all.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of times, like you take, it's kind of like, you know, responsibility, mm-hmm. but it's like just the self-assessment. And like there are a lot of the poets, like I'm into poetry, like in the mm-hmm. Victorian age, people have the idea of the looking glass self. Mm-hmm. And the concept of the looking glass self is like, it's not the outside world that's doing it. Look in that mirror.
Right.
And where you are is because of who you see in that mirror.
Right.
It's not the other person. It's not this. It's not that. It's that looking glass self. And you start to do that assessment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then you can actually, you're ready to realize that I got to start challenging that person in the mirror. I got to
say,
why do they believe? Why do I believe this? Why am I doing that? It's not because, you know, it could be that something happened in your childhood, mm-hmm. but you are where you are now. You know,
right.
So
you're not in your childhood anymore.
Yeah, ain't change what that is because your dad's not controlling you right now. You know, you're not there.
Right. Well, and it's the same. It's the same concept of the idea of when you point a finger at somebody, there's three fingers pointing back at you, and so you always have to, you know, you have to keep in mind that. And the only thing that we can control is ourselves and our reactions to what goes on. Anything that happens outside of us, we have no control over. We have no right to control it. And we have to allow, the same way we don't want to be controlled, we don't get to control other people's behaviors, other people's choices, but we absolutely get to control how we respond to what someone else does and how we then respond to it in turn. And I think the changing of thoughts and the creation of better self-talk is absolutely, I mean, I think it's paramount to just overall happiness in life. Yeah, is how we talk empowering. To how we talk to ourselves is, I mean, our relationship with ourselves is the most important relationship. And most people, like, that concept is just so mind-boggling that it's like they can't even, like, they're like, what do you mean my relationship with myself? What does that mean? And it's like, well, you know, you it's really hard for some people to really grasp the fact that those thoughts that go on in your head and the inner dialogue that you have when it is in any way negative, which most of, well, you know, everybody has it, but when have constant negative dialogue with themselves, we get it from the outside. We don't need to be helping ourselves by doing it to ourselves, like, as well.
There's a lot of the idea, like my practice, I'm a Buddhist, but there's a concept of the law of attraction. So if I focus on my melancholy or dark thoughts or negative thoughts, then it's going to kind of hang around me like a bad rainstorm.
Absolutely.
So I start thinking and believing and feeling that I belong in a better place, then opportunities start to show up.
Absolutely.
And it seems magical, but your brain, your mind power, your spirit power, if you can actually access the positivity, you will get closer to that, you know, actualization of yourself.
Right.
Because that's going to get you where you need to be. But a lot of people don't. They well, that's foo-foo. You know, so they can't even conceive it.
Yeah.
Because they think it's going to be some outside thing that's going to do it, rather than realizing that you are your own power. You can... You can change where you are at any time
with just
the mind power and the spirit power and your heart power. You're like that can, all those pillars that, like, you can use them.
Absolutely. And another concept that I think is really important for anybody, and you don't have to be dealing with anything. I think it's just a concept that most people don't understand, is that your brain, and I tell my clients all the time, your brain is like a third party. Like, your brain is not going to tell you the things that, you know, so many people are like, well, gosh, you know, I just keep thinking the same thoughts and they're so destructive, or they're, you know, I wish I wouldn't think that thought. Well, you can tell your brain that you don't want to think that thought anymore, because
you
we have to think
of it,
we have to think of our brain as that third party, because our brain, from an evolutionary standpoint, our brain does whatever it can to keep us alive, and keeping us alive.
Stay safe.
And so we're always, when you feel like, oh my gosh, I always go to the worst case scenario. Well, yeah, your brain does that because that's a survival technique, but that doesn't mean we have to do that. That doesn't mean that just because it goes to the worst case scenario, that doesn't mean you have to believe it. And that doesn't mean you have to do anything to make that happen. But it's having those conversations. And one of the pattern that I teach my clients is to pay attention to your thoughts. And when a negative thought comes in, you have a conversation with that part of your brain, your conversation of like, no, we don't think that way anymore. You know, one of the things that I was, you know, the word stupid, I heard the word stupid all the time in my childhood. And so to me, you know, Kristen and stupid, that, oh, he obviously talking to me, obviously that must be me. And so a lot of times I will still hear that word stupid come up, you know, drop something on the floor, forget my keys, forget something. Oh, that was really, you know, that was really stupid of you, thinking that thought. And what I have to do is that it had that interrupt of like, no, that's not how we think anymore. It's not true, but we don't think that way about ourselves anymore. And it's having that internal dialogue with yourself to tell yourself, no, you don't do that anymore. That's an old pattern. We don't do that anymore. And here's what I do think about myself. And then you come back with a positive, and you come back with something that is that's going to reestablish your value, reestablish and remind yourself of who you are, and remind yourself of who you want to be. But we have to stop buying into the garbage that our brain's giving us.
Yeah,
garbage is coming from our childhood that is not necessary. That's not one. It's not necessarily, it's not true. But secondly, it's not serving our lives as an adult. And so again, you know, for anybody listening, if your life isn't where you want it, and you're not moving in the direction that you want to be in, and you're unhappy, the first thing you need to do is you need to start listening to your thoughts. Like, what are you saying to yourself? And if what you're saying to yourself is really negative, you need to start paying attention to that and having that dialogue with your brain. And again, it's not you that's saying those things. It's your brain. Your brain's telling you those things because it thinks that that's the best thing for you. And the other thing is our brain will only repeat thoughts that we are giving it. So if we have a negative thought, if you go 5 minutes without a negative thought, your brain thinks, well, and it doesn't decipher between positive and negative. It just knows what thoughts, you know, what thoughts do I think all the time? So if it's a negative thought and you keep thinking it, your brain will keep feeding you that thought because it's like, oh, they must like that thought because they keep thinking it. We want to keep them happy. Let's keep giving them that thought. And so people will say, gosh, I wish I could stop thinking that. It's like, you can, but when the thought comes in, you've got to push it away. You've got to say, nope, that's not what we do. I'm not thinking about that anymore. And it has to be a really, really active, like, you know, really and really clear and declarative and consistent of, no, that's not a thought. I'm not going to believe it and I'm not going to hear it anymore. And that can really significantly change the pattern of the negative thoughts coming in.
Do you ever have clients that have a hard time getting their arms around actually doing that because they don't realize that they actually have the power to do that?
I have had clients that in the beginning couldn't even hear their thoughts. When I would say like, so what are you thinking? And they'd be like, I don't really know. I don't know. Like, I really don't know what you're talking about. Like my thoughts, like, what do you mean by that? And they're also, I had clients that couldn't recognize what their feelings were. They couldn't, they maybe had two feelings and it was happy or sad or mad. Like that was it. There were three feelings and there was nothing in between. And they even had a hard time deciphering what they were feeling in certain moments. And when I'd say, well, what are you thinking? And they'd be like, I don't know what I'm thinking. And so if we can't, and that's also because people sometimes don't realize that they actually have thoughts and that the thoughts that they think are actual things that they can control as well. Yeah. They don't think they can control them, but once they learn it, it is mind blowing and it changes their lives.
So when you have people like that, does it help for them to kind of put that into a notebook or a diary or a voice memo and actually start to assess their thoughts? Because they weren't never really, a lot of times maybe they were taught in a certain type of family that didn't really think that that's real.
Right.
And think that you should have other things or what you should be thinking. So they don't, they never even tried to analyze that because they're like, that's foo-foo or that's whatever. That's not real.
Right.
So once they start to entertain, they're like, well, that wasn't working for me to be in that paradigm. So now I'm going to have to open my mind a little bit, get a little more expansive and see how far I can actually dive into myself.
Yeah. And usually, and to be totally honest, usually people who end up working with me, usually they have to be open-minded to begin with. Because they have to be, and I can usually tell that when I'm just having an initial consultation with somebody as to whether or not, because, and I will be honest with somebody. I've gotten to a point in my career that I am, when I have a consultation with somebody, they are not interviewing me. I am interviewing them. I'm finding out if we're a fit to work together. And if I feel like there is so much resistance or they're just like, oh, I just want to lose weight. I just want my weight to go down. I'm like, okay, well, if you're not really interested in changing anything else and changing, you know, looking at your thoughts, looking at your life, looking at your beliefs, you know, changing who you are at your core, not changing who you are, but reevaluating and really getting back to who you really are, then I'm not the right person. And then I will tell them, I'm like, I have great, you know, great friends that are, you know, fitness trainers and trainers who will help you lose weight. But I can promise you that in 6 months, you're going to gain that weight right back.
Yeah, because you're on that diet fitness kind of train. Well, if you're into these like step programs and the stuff you see that, you know, people kind of selling it, like pitches. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, to me, it's like what you start to realize, like it's hard to tailor make that pitch to everybody, right? Mm-hmm. What you get into is the individual self. That's all different.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, everybody's different.
Standard type of process is like, there's certain concepts,
mm-hmm.
but you're looking at the individual as the individual, right? So you have to kind of uncover the person in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why one of the reasons why I when I started my business, and I moved into, I really moved, you know, more deliberately into dealing just with emotional eaters. I was doing one-on-one coaching, and then I moved away from that for a few years, and I did more of a one-to-many, and I had a membership, and I closed that about 3 or 4 months ago because I wasn't seeing the results for my clients that I wanted them to have, and mm-hmm. it was feeling to me. And I loved my members in my membership, and I still have, you know, connections with many of them, but it, for me, I really needed to get back to that one-on-one to really help somebody. If I really wanted to enact really lasting change, it's not a quick fix. It's not, you know, I even tell people like 3 months, that's just way too short. It didn't take us 3 months to get here. It took you almost probably a half to three quarters of your life. We're not going to get rid of this in a year. I mean, this is going to be one of the things I had a coach that told me that it was 6 months to a habit change, a year and a half to, belief change, and then lifestyle changes, usually between 2 and 3 years of consistently doing and consistently working on an issue and working on whatever it is that you're doing. There has to be that really ingrained, you have to, and it takes time. It's time.
That's what a lot of people don't want to hear, because they want to hear that it's like the 6-step, 5-step, 10-step.
And there's a button you can push.
It's like the magic pill, you know?
Yeah.
And they're all, because that's where we're at, a very kind of, I want it now.
Right.
And a lot of times it's like, it's all the work. It's like mm-hmm. anybody you see where they are, if you get the quick fit story, it seems like they just did it overnight.
Absolutely.
There's no overnight.
Well, that's super clear in music. I mean, musicians, I mean, somebody like Lizzo, people are like, oh my gosh, where did Lizzo come from? She came out of nowhere. And it was like, you hear her story and you're thinking, no, she was working in clubs and doing all of her, I mean, for, you know, 10 years before anybody.
Yeah, it's like Lady Gaga the same way. Like she wasn't Lady Gaga. She was playing her keyboards and looking like, not like in the way, like the way she looks now. She remade herself. She had a whole process. It didn't mm-hmm. happen overnight. And like all the stories of the great, you know, even the CEOs, it's like they didn't happen overnight. They made mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody acts like, oh, they didn't make any mistakes. Like, you can't get there without breaking some eggs. I mean, that's what happens.
Exactly. So any process change, anytime we want to change something, you know, whether it is whether it's a habit, whether it's, you know, from an addiction, it's something that we're looking at. One of the things that James Clear writes about in his book, Atomic Habits, is he really focuses on, instead of working on the habits first, you want to actually work on your identity and who is the person that you want to become. And then the habits support that identity change. But we have to start with, okay, who's the person that I want to become, and what would they do in this moment of now? I've kind of like the rubber meeting the road, you know, whether it's like, I want to work out, I don't want to work out, or I want to go get something from the fridge, or I don't want to eat. You know, what would the person that you want to become, what would they do in this moment? And that's where you really start to get the identity change, is when you start to take on, you actually, you know, and again, that can be taken on, whether it's just through thought, whether it's through daily affirmations, mantras, any of those things that you can do at a conscious level, where you're really starting to make those connections with the person that you want to become. And again, programming and reinstating the new beliefs that you want to have about yourself.
Yeah. It's really that, you know, our brain is the ultimate computer. Mm-hmm. I'm a software designer. Like, you put something on a loop, and like, we get bad loops that cause problems, and the loop just goes on for that, you know, wreck the mm-hmm. program for won't function.
Right.
So a lot of times I think like, well, our brain's doing that. Mm-hmm. It's like looping, like what we see in the machine. Like, we can see that there are some of these loops going on in right. the human brain mm-hmm. that are not very helpful. Right. Like, you think it's like protecting you, but it's really stagnation. Like mm-hmm. you're not moving because you're kind of being like a deer caught in the headlights. It's like right. what's going on? You got to get out of that and learn how to deal with the triggers, right? And learn how mm-hmm. to deal with that, you know, uncomfortable situation and learn mm-hmm. how to manage it mm-hmm. and figure out how to, you know, that's why a lot of times it's like if you're an athlete, you do those 1,000 hours or 10,000 hours mm-hmm. to get that shot or get that certain play. You know, musicians, we do the same thing. Mm-hmm. We get 10,000 hours of playing a bass and then you don't have to look at it.
Right.
Then it's just automatic. You could be singing, you could be jumping around, you do because it's automatic. You did the work. Now you trust yourself.
Right. Right.
Like, the problem is if like, you suddenly like you have to really ask yourself what note you're on. You already know it, right? Like
right.
you start to doubt. Like, why do you doubt it? You know you got it.
Right.
That's when you know you got like, oh, there's an issue. I need to figure out this.
Right.
But now I don't believe I have it.
Well, and it becomes that subconscious just kind of takes over. And when our subconscious is working for us, it's amazing because it happens that way, you know, like driving a car. It's like, it just happens automatically. You just do it. And unfortunately, our subconscious also has a lot of bad habits that we don't want to have. And so they continue, and the subconscious works in the exact same way. It will just keep repeating the same behaviors and the same things over and over. And that's why, you know, when people get frustrated and they say, gosh, I know what I need to do. Why am I not doing it? It's like, well, that's your subconscious because you've taught it that that's the pattern. That's the automatic response. And it can unlearn it, but it again, it takes time, takes commitment.
Discipline. Yeah. It's kind of like a lot of Eastern practices, mm-hmm. you know, have the level of discipline to kind of sit there mm-hmm. in your thoughts,
right?
Breathing like Tai Chi and chanting mm-hmm. and in just meditation. And sometimes the Western mindset is like, well, I don't know. I can't meditate. I can't do the breathing exercise. I can't do Tai Chi. I want something quicker.
Right.
And it's really right. at the end of the day, like you're going to have to find a way, mm-hmm. whether it's like maybe Eastern philosophy ain't the thing, but figuring out what works for you, there mm-hmm. is a certain level of discipline and reprogramming that's going to require, you know, an effort. And if that's not comfortable, well, mm-hmm. you're going to have some discomfort until it becomes comfortable.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the whole idea of like, we've got to start accepting and understanding and not always trying to move away from the discomfort or think like, oh, this is uncomfortable. I really want to do it. Okay. I just won't do it. And, you know, pushing yourself to do things that aren't comfortable and trusting that there is learning and there is growth that's going to happen each and every time we do that. Each time we push ourselves to do something that's just a little bit uncomfortable, we're going to grow as a person, and that's going to benefit us in the long run. But most people are so instantaneous and want that immediate, what's the immediate benefit going to be for me? And so we have to try and really kind of meter that and really try to change and know that when we address discomfort in the moment, the long-term impact is going to be much more positive for us.
Yeah, it's just the time, you know, we have so many distractions and so mm-hmm. much noise. Mm-hmm. Like why I try to teach people, like when you're in the creative zone, like sometimes you need to get disconnected from your cell phone. Mm-hmm. Don't have the TV on, don't have mm-hmm. the radio on. Kind of sit there with your thoughts.
Right.
And then don't overthink it. Just kind of find a place to get at peace. You go for a mm-hmm. walk in the woods. Mm-hmm. You know, go do something to kind of get your mind disconnect and then right. come back. And then you can have some clarity. Mm-hmm. But if you're like mm-hmm. so connected and so triggered and all these inputs coming in, you're getting overwhelmed. You're going to have a hard time trying to have any kind of balance.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, that's very true. Very true.
But I want to thank you again for a lot of the things we've been talking about, because it's really, you know, amazing your process, which is like, maybe we'd like to ask you a couple, like, were there like three top like lessons learned since you've been doing this that you could kind of relate to the art audience like over time?
Sure.
In terms of what you're doing?
Absolutely. I would say the three things that have been most pivotal for me, and I think that are most pivotal for my clients are again, the consistency, being consistent and knowing that you have to take care of yourself first. There's a lot of what I do has a lot to do with self-care and taking care of yourself and putting yourself first, because most, and I work almost exclusively with women, but most, to a person, almost every, and I have worked with men as well, but my business is primarily focused on women. But to a person that I've worked with, everyone always puts other people first. So really prioritizing your needs and prioritizing what's going to be the best thing for you, and taking care of yourself and doing something good for yourself every single day. And whether that is doing a little journaling, making a gratitude list, going for a little walk in the morning by yourself, whatever that is, but having a little bit of self-care each day, super important. So that's the first thing. Second one I would say is realizing that everyone is on their own path. Everyone is doing what they're doing. Everyone's trying to do the best they can just to get through the day. And most of us, myself included, need to stop taking things so personally and stop making it be about you. Because I'm going to tell y'all, it's 90% of the time, it's not about you. And even if it is about you and somebody's upset with you, okay, if they don't like you, that's okay. You're not going to die. You're going to be fine. If somebody's upset, that's okay. You know, if you've wronged them, yes, we need to right our wrongs, but people are not always going to like us, and that's going to be okay too. And then the last thing is to allow yourself to feel emotion. Allow yourself, when you're upset, acknowledge that you're upset, acknowledge how you feel, acknowledge what happened, and be able to sit with those feelings. If people just sat with their emotions and allowed their emotions to be present and didn't yell or scream or create all these other scenarios that are going along with it, usually a uncomfortable, unhappy feeling will usually pass between 90 seconds and 2 minutes. Our bodies will not hold on to them. But what we do is we keep creating looping. That's looping. We start getting the looping thoughts about what someone's done and how we've been wronged. And that just perpetuates. And it can turn into 5 days of just being angry and upset. When if you just sat with your emotions and acknowledge them and allow them to be present, instead of trying to do everything to avoid them, your life would be much easier. And you notice how easily those feelings can go away.
I think that's very important points. You know, those lessons learned are like, that's life. Like life, like how you manage it and how you learn to not get triggered, like you're saying, right. and be able to be understanding. Like everybody, it's not all about you. It's like everybody's having their own issue that might intersect with you, but it really wasn't personal. It was like they're on their own path. Yeah. And once you learn, you know, to not get triggered by, you know, the road rage, you know, you get out and do something that you don't have to have those road rage moments in life. You know, but a lot of times people are taking that kind of road rage and they're putting it through their whole life. They're having all kinds of things trigger the same feeling, you know, and response. And you're like, you don't need to be on that path.
Right. No, because the only person it hurts is you. The only person who suffers is when you do that, it's the only person that suffers is you, because the other person is moving on with their life. They're doing their thing. You're perpetuating it by creating those looping thoughts. And that doesn't benefit you. And again, in the case with my clients, it then becomes an issue, because then to get those thoughts to go away, we have to distract ourselves, and we distract ourselves with food. And that just becomes more and more of an issue.
Well, I want to thank you again for being on the Absolutely. Podcast. And we do have your Instagram handle there at Breakthrough Emotional Eating. And you'll be able to check that out on Instagram if you want to connect with you there. And again, thank you for being a guest on the Family Electric Ghost Podcast. We were just on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. We'll be on all the other platforms that you can listen to or watch a podcast by tomorrow. So thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Have a good night.